and skies are cloudy and gray. They're only gray for a day. Wrap your troubles in dreams. Dream your troubles away. Until that sunshine peeks through, there's only one thing to do. Wrap your troubles in dreams. Dream all your troubles away.
In honor of Sinatra's 100th birthday, Pete Hamill's classic tribute returns with a new introduction by the author. It is a unique homage to an American icon. Pete Hamill evokes the essence of Sinatra, examining his art and his legend from the inside as only a friend of many years could do. Shaped by Prohibition, the Depression, and war, Francis Albert Sinatra became the troubadour of urban loneliness with the songs he enabled millions to come together. The name of the book is Why Sinatra Matters, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Pete Hamill back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
When this book came out in 1998, what was the rationale behind it? What did you want to do?
I wanted to answer the question, why does it matter? He had died. A lot of the stories about his death, kind of obituaries, were about the consenting adults that he slept with rather than what he really added to American life, which is the music. And I thought I should sit down and do a kind of essay and memoir of the little that I knew about him and hope to correct the record to a certain extent. I have heard from his family and others that this helps correct that record a little bit.
How well did you know him?
I was one of his New York friends. I didn't go out and hang around in his house in California or anything like that. He would come here to play dates, and he'd call me at 11:30 at night and say, "Did you eat yet?" You know, and I would to hop out and meet them at Patsy's or P.J. Clark's or wherever he and his friends were. But we became friends, and at one point he wanted me to write his book. I didn't really want to do that kind of work as a writer, you know, to rent my fingers out to help somebody's legacy or something. But I thought about it and said, okay, let me think about it and see if I can do that. And in the course of trying to figure it out, he told me a lot of things. And it turned out that I did not write the book. There is no book by Frank Sinatra. And I wish there were. There were some mysteries still about him. But there's a whole bunch of new books that I hope decodes some of that, you know. I liked him very much. He was a reader because he was an insomniac. He couldn't sleep at night. I met him through another insomniac friend, Jimmy Cannon, the sports writer. I met him after a fight in Las Vegas one night for the first time, and then he sort of liked me. He was picky and choosy about his media friends, because he had some bad experiences with some of the media. And he would call me when he got to New York. I was always delighted to see him and hear him and spend a few hours in the fading light of day.
You write in the introduction to the book, the new introduction, about a gallery at Lincoln Center that had a look at his life, a Sinatra,
right,
American icon. And you write, Sinatra, the public man, was, of course, well documented. There he was, smiling or somber outside theaters or openings, or if we were lucky, if we could afford the price of admission in small clubs in big cities. But there were no pictures of him alone on the Hoboken waterfront, staring across the Hudson at the magical New York skyline. No notes on what he was thinking.
I think that's the heart of the matter on the personal side. Remember something. He was an only child in an era when immigrant families are all pretty large. My own family in Brooklyn, different generation, but there were seven kids, of which I was the oldest. And here was Sinatra all by himself, trying to figure out, you know, what the hell the world's all about. No older brother, no even better older sister who would tell him, you know, what he was looking at. So he stumbled around trying to find out. And I think of the two women in his life that were so important, the first was Nancy. And I think Nancy helped him to understand certain things and help build his confidence that he could have a life beyond his wildest dreams when he was 20 years old. The other one was Ava Gardner, who helped Sinatra knock himself down and then get up, which that generation always did, the best of that generation, and do the greatest work of his career when he met Nelson Riddle and other terrific musicians. And the rest of it was all a footnote. And sometimes in my book, I have a whole section near the end where we just were driving around one night before he went home. He had a date that night, and he sent her home in a taxi, and then he was, you know, it was one of those nights where he knew he was going home alone. And I think his expression, his defining of male human loneliness, what young men thought about when it was them and the moonlight, is one of his great contributions to changing the United States. It's no accident that he started out with a primarily female audience and ended up with a primarily male audience. I think he was singing for all those guys who learned how to accept defeat with a woman that they might have loved, but to do it with a kind of stoic grace. He wasn't raging. He wasn't throwing bottles through the window. He said, okay, it's a 2:45, and there's no one in the place except you and me. Then off he would go with the bartender. I think he was very important. He was very important on another level, too, that he helped, with a couple of other guys, he helped change the image of Italian Americans in the United States. He and Fiorella LaGuardia and Joe DiMaggio created a difference. The organ grinder with the monkey, the dancing monkey on the street, vanished. Suddenly, here was this man singing certainly an urban version of America's greatest songs and helping people get through the night. So that was, I think, a huge contribution to our life, the kind of thing that only popular culture does. You don't stand around after your woman left you humming Puccini. you're liable to, there's a variety of people you might be humming, but that, you know, it's not grandiose. It's not immense. It's a whisper often.
You write in the book that his finest accomplishment, of course, was the sound. The voice itself would evolve over the years from a violin to a viola to a cello with a rich middle register and dark bottom tones. But it was a combination of voice, diction, attitude, and taste in music that produced the unique Sinatra sound.
Yeah, that's the way I feel from listening to a lot of it for most of my life. I once asked him if he thought of himself as a singer or a musician. And he said, a musician, and my instrument is the microphone. And the microphone allowed him, in a room with 5,000 seats, to whisper, not literally, but to express himself with intimacy that could be understood on the second balcony. He was able to do that. He was the first guy that was able to do that, partly because of the technology. It got better. You know, Russ Colombo didn't have that kind of a mic, or Rudy Vallee, or even Crosby at the beginning of their career. By the time Sinatra is a star, the technology is helping him to be able to relax into a song and sing it like it's coming from him. And now, although these were songs that were written by some of the greatest pop music composers, from Gershwin and Rodgers and Hart and, you know, on, he had the quality that he, I'm sure, discovered in Billie Holiday when he saw her, his exact contemporary, that she was able to make the music autobiography. So was Sinatra. You thought that no matter what, who wrote the song, it was about Sinatra. And that takes a kind of musical genius.
With this centennial, what do you hope people realize about Sinatra?
I hope they understand the context in which a lot of the music was performed. In other words, it was music that had the right angles of a city in it, rather than the open, wide plains of the West, or the farmlands, or any of the other possible ways that you could visualize music in a country as vast as ours. But his was the music of cities. I hope they can feel that now, that the city is changing. This city that I live in, other cities in the country, are different, as they should be, because a city is dynamic. It's always changing. You know, no matter what, it's why one of the strongest, most powerful emotions in a city is nostalgia. Because you look up and suddenly Ebbets Field is gone, and so is the Polo Grounds, and they got a new version of Yankee Stadium. It's changing all the time. Certain neighborhoods fell into slumhood in the 50s and 60s because of heroin and other problems. Now you can't afford to rent a single room in the place. The prices are so high in Brooklyn and Queens and other places. So the sense of the dynamic, that is not about being loud. It's not shouting. It can be intimate. It can be full of hurt sometimes. But it was something that Sinatra articulated better than almost anybody else that I can think of during the years in which he was active.
The name of the book is Why Sinatra Matters. There's a new introduction for the 100th birthday. Pete Hamill, always a pleasure and an honor to speak with you. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much. Again, Pete Hamill's book is Why Sinatra Matters. It is published by Little Brown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
These little town blues. Yeah.
It's up to you, New York.